Democrats and Republicans in Springfield have finally agreed on a bill to fund our public schools. We'll be joined by Senators Jason Barrickman and Kimberly Lightford on why they voted yes. Plus, when Marianne Mohan Raj wrote her first book, her publisher said her Sri Lankan parents weren't the intended audience.
They said, South Asians aren't your target demographic. And I said, what is my target demographic? And the editor at HarperCollins said, white women ages 40 to 60.
The Chicago writer is also the founder of Jaggery. We talked to her about this online literary magazine that's demographic is to highlight South Asian voices from all over the world. And what can baby pigs teach us about infant brain development?
As our brain develops, there's a lot of different processes that are occurring all at once. What we wanted to understand was, do these microbiota at all play into these changes that we know occur throughout development?
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. After missing the first three payments to K-12 public schools this year, our state government has finally agreed on a plan to fund them. Governor Rauner is expected to sign that bill in Chicago this afternoon around 2:30. Yesterday, he visited Ida J. Russell Elementary School in Litchfield. That's about 45 miles south of Springfield. He explained to the students what this new law will mean for schools across the state.
From now on, schools around the state of Illinois won't give a whole ton of money to a few schools and not much to others. Everybody's going to get the same amount. So every student, you guys get treated the same way here in Litchfield as in every other community across the state of Illinois. So, again, thank you to our legislators for leadership. But you know what? The real thanks is to your moms and dads and especially to our teachers. Let's have one more round of applause for the teachers here in Ida Russell School.
That's audio of Governor Rauner explaining the bill to the elementary school students in Litchfield. That's audio provided by his office, by the way. And again, he's expected to sign the school funding bill this afternoon. I'm joined on the line now by two of the chief Senate sponsors of this bill. Republican State Senator Jason Barrickman represents Illinois' 53rd Senate District in Central Illinois, includes a couple of counties, all are parts of Ford, Iroquois, Vermilion counties, and more. I'm also joined by Democratic State Senator Kimberly Lightford, who represents Illinois' 4th Senate District in Chicago's western suburbs. Senator Barrickman, Senator Lightford, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having us on.
I wanted to start for both of you by playing some audio from Superintendent Phil Cox. He's in Salt Fork District 512. That's about 20 miles east of Champaign. The new school funding formula means his district will get about $39,000 more a year.
It's by no means perfect, but it is better than the previous way that Illinois funded schools. It's a lot more equitable now.
I know that compromise is hard, especially in this state. Senator Lightford, do you agree with Superintendent Cox's assessment of this of the bill?
I do. I think all of our focus all along was to ensure that we enacted a funding formula that was adequate, that was equitable, and that really got at the need of the school district. And I believe we accomplished that goal. So if there's a $39,000 increase for the superintendent's district, apparently there was a greater need that needed to be addressed that was not being addressed in the previous formula.
And sorry, let me correct myself. $69,000, actually, not $39,000. But Senator Barrickman, your thoughts on this compromise? An imperfect compromise, but a necessary one nonetheless?
Well, it's certainly necessary. And I think, you know, fundamentally, what this agreement reflects is a major shift in public policy and the manner in which the state funds our public schools, K through 12. You know, there's some 850 plus school districts around the state. And as my colleague, you know, and friend Senator Lightford says, we are now targeting those districts in need. You know, the superintendent's comments, I think, are spot on that this is a major shift, that it's a positive shift, and also that there's more work that needs to be done. You know, so as much as I think there's going to be a victory lap, you know, with the governor's signature placed on this historic legislation, none of us can go home and think that the job's done. Our schools continue to need our support, and I think they'll get that support if the two parties continue to work together in a bipartisan manner like we've done here.
As you, to that point, Senator Berkman, to the parties working together, Senator Lightford, I wanted to start with the last minute and to summon your party controversial addition of a $75 million tax credit for people who donate to private school scholarships. Superintendent Matt Klosterman from Belleville District 118, that's in the St. Louis Metro East area, he expressed a disappointment about the tax credit for donations to private schools. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'm kind of disappointed that that piece worked its way into the legislation, but I understand there's always a give and take when you come up with compromises and negotiate things.
Senator Lightford, Senator Biss, and others called it a voucher program. Representative Will Guzzardi said it was essentially using public dollars to encourage people to leave public schools for private ones. What was your pitch to fellow Democrats who had concerns about this?
Well, let me just say this. I want to ensure that all children have an opportunity to learn at their pace and their parents have the support of the community that they need. And having been around the legislature and the Senate Education Committee for 18 years, we've tried a number of things to help close the academic achievement gap and to improve conditions. And there's been voucher bills in the past that I've supported some and I've not supported others. And the same with charter schools. I think the greatest concern from my colleagues was that there would be funds taken from public education to go to private schools in the form of a voucher. And so I think it was important for me to note to my colleagues that in order to reach a compromise, there's always give and take. And there was initiatives that the Republicans wanted as well as initiatives that the Democrats want. And in order for us to acknowledge what's best for all of our children, we have to give and take and kind of shake the, you know, the cart a little bit. It's nothing that I love, but the overall bill and the $7 billion that go into education, I think $75 million is a small number. And so that's why I was in support of it. I think I look at the big picture. We have a new funding formula that's going to help over 2 million children. School districts will know what they're receiving in a timely fashion. The evidence-based model is amazing. There's 27 elements that really gets at the root of improving our children's test scores. And those were the things that were far more important to me than the voucher program. It did arrive very late in the discussions, and I think that's what the real issues are. Members felt like it should have been vetted. It should have went to committee. There was tons of questions that needed to be answered, and that did not happen. So over the years, the Republicans always say we bring things in the 12th hour. That was definitely an initiative that they laid on the table in the 12th hour.
Well, Senator Berkman, some of your fellow Republicans who voted no cited concerns about revenue. And I'm thinking, for example, of Representative David Harris. He said on WTTW that the state needs to be on a tight fiscal diet and that we shouldn't be starting new programs like a $75 million tax credit or $40 million for CPS teacher pensions. What did you say to your fellow Republicans who brought that up as a concern?
Sure. You know, great questions. And first, you know, first and foremost, let me put to rest the, you know, some of the rhetoric that's out there, you know, and coming from those who have found opposition in this. Some of it's just this not true. I mean, this program, though new, is not going to utilize one state dollar and take away one state dollar from any school district. It's not a voucher program. It's a tax credit. The state has many other tax credits in law today where we incentivize behaviors. And consider this. Consider the incentive or the behavior that we're incentivizing. Individual donors are going to make contributions to scholarships, and children around the state who come from low-income families and are today at a low-performing school are going to have opportunities to obtain these scholarships and use them at other schools where maybe their educational needs are better met. I think because of that, that's why you saw some bipartisan support to this. It's not state money, and it's about giving those children educational opportunities.
Yeah, Senator Berkman, can I ask you just a question about, I think maybe that, I appreciate you saying that. I wonder for people who look at this idea of the whole model, that it being an evidence-based funding formula, certainly something where we're now going from being one of the worst in the country, hopefully to being one of the best at how we fund our schools. Because it's an evidence-based model, it is based on numbers of school populations. And there have been some who say, what if numbers of lower performing schools, if those students go then to use that this program to go to private schools, does that make these lower performing schools worse off?
No, I mean, one of the negotiated items here was the implementation of what's called a hold harmless. So even as, you know, for whatever reasons, if school districts are seeing shifts in their population, the state is committing to hold them harmless at their current appropriation levels. So I think those concerns are unfounded again. And as people come, you know, I understand that there's going to be some attention to this program. That's good. I think as people really put their attention to the details of it, I think that they're going to find that many of their concerns don't really have the merit maybe that they think at first blush.
Sure. Well, Senator Bergman, when will this new funding formula actually go into effect?
Well, I think, you know, as soon as possible. My understanding is that the State Board of Education has really been preparing itself for many months for the implementation of an evidence-based model. I think that there was widespread agreement among both parties to implement that. The devil was in some of the details, which we had to sort out over the summer. But the State Board generally is ready. I think they are working currently to catch our school districts up on the missed payments, the state aid payments. That have already lapsed. I think the goal is to get those payments out the door. And my understanding, and I think this will be fleshed out in the coming days here, but my understanding is that even if all of the loose ends aren't kind of tidied up with the State Board of Education, they're going to get those payments out, make sure that some of our school districts that are in dire needs for cash right now to make payroll and other things have that money. And they may true them up, you know, in the coming months as they refine kind of their implementation of the program. But I anticipate checks going to school districts very soon.
Senator Lightford, Senator Berkman's just been talking about the checks going out. Obviously, we know the vulnerable situation some districts have been in. Some districts saying they only had enough cash on hand to last until October. That's the short-term pain. We also know from school superintendents how many problems they've faced over the past several years with the funding formula. We just went from one of the worst in the nation in terms of equitably funding our schools to one of the best. And so I guess my question to you is, how long do you think it will take to undo all of the damage from our previous funding formula?
You know, I don't know that it'll be a short fix. I think that it'll take a couple years, perhaps even longer. It depends on how much we're able to put into the formula each year. So this year we have $350 million, but $50 million of that in FY19 will go to another initiative that the Republicans brought up. So about $300 million. We know that we need more, closer to about $500 million a year to get to that $1 billion number. So I would say it takes 4 to 5 years before we have reached the level that where we would see the greatest impact of the evidence-based model. But I believe each year we'll just chip away. We're hoping that we can get school districts at adequacy as quickly as we can. And those school districts that need funds the most will be in the Tier 1 system, so they will receive the monies off the bat. I heard the governor's comments earlier in saying all the schools would get the same amount of money, and I don't know that that was a true statement to make. To Senator Bergman's point, we did hold all our school districts harmless to the level of spending that they're currently receiving, which is a number that is different statewide. So hopefully just putting money into this formula over the next 4 to 5 years bring us to a great place that we really want to be.
Yeah, thanks for that, Senator Lightford. To be fair, I think that was perhaps Governor Rauner's explanation to an elementary school audience of the funding formula. That said, we just have a minute or two left, and I just want to end by asking both of you. Both of you have talked about the compromise, how hard it was for both of you all to work with both parties. We've got the budget in place. We funded public schools for this year. We've changed the funding formula. I want to ask both of you, what's next for you on education policy? What's one other another major issue that you'd like to push going forward? Senator Lightfoot, do you want to start?
Absolutely. I've got a couple. I think the most important out the gate is financing. We still have to ensure that there's an adequate amount of funds going into the formula. Otherwise, we would kind of be putting what, the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse. Yeah, I always mess up those little cliches. But it's important that we ensure that we have adequate financing. So that will be my number one going forward. And how do we generate enough revenue to put into our education system so that the evidence-based model is successful?
Senator, I just want to make sure Senator Berkman has time to put his priorities forward, too. Thanks for that, Senator Lightfoot. Senator Berkman?
Yeah, no, and I certainly appreciate and, acknowledge what Senator Lightfoot said. I think she's spot on. I think to add to that, you know, we have a impending teacher shortage around the state. Some of that is a reflection of burdens that the state has put forward. Some of it's a reflection of the fact that young people aren't choosing to teach in our public school systems. And so I think there's some efforts that we can take there to address the teacher shortage. This is, you know, for me as a downstater, we're really feeling this in some of our rural communities that are trying to attract, you know, high quality math and science teachers. And we need to do more as a state to make sure that the teachers that we need are available to teach our students. It's an issue downstate. I suspect it's an issue in Chicago and maybe in some of our suburban communities as well. But certainly downstate, that is a top priority for us to wrestle with immediately.
Thanks for that. That is Republican Senator Jason Berkman from Central Illinois. I want to thank Democratic State Senator Kimberly Lightfoot from Chicago suburban area. Both of you, thanks for being with me. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on the funding formula.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Jaggery is an international online literary journal that started in Chicago 2 years ago. Its goal to encourage a literary dialogue between South Asians wherever they are, whether they're in Asia or living abroad. Its founder and editor-in-chief, Marianne Mohan-Rosh, is here with me in studio to talk about their latest issue, which is just out. Hey, Marianne, welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having us.
So I should say editor-in-chief not for long, but you will talk about that in a minute. But I wanted to start with the name, Jaggery. Can you explain what that is and why you chose it?
Sure. It's sort of funny. I was actually just cooking with Jaggery literally half an hour ago. Jaggery is a sweet. It is it's dark sugar, really, cane sugar. And it's eaten widely throughout South Asia. We picked it for a couple of reasons. One is I was looking to evoke memory. And for me, as a diasporan person who came to the U.S. from Sri Lanka when I was 2.5, Jaggery was a treasure. My mother had a hard time getting foods from back home, and she would hoard it when she could get it, because you couldn't buy it in Connecticut in 1973, certainly. So she would have these solid half discs of dark jaggery and would store them in the kitchen, and I would sneak in the middle of the night and take a big chef's knife and carve off little bits of it.
Did she notice?
Well, she never said anything, but my mother has an eagle eye. I'm sure she noticed. But I thought I was very clever. I loved it. I loved the taste. And for me, when I try to write about Sri Lanka, it's such a process of taking these very tenuous threads and trying to find connections between my life here and my life there. And so when we were thinking about a magazine that would be part of a conversation between diaspora and homelanders, it seemed like jaggery was a good metaphor. And it's also, it's just a very, it's an important food there. You know, it's given to workers when they take a break in the middle of a hot day after working in the fields. A little jaggery will help sustain you. It's considered very healthy in Ayurvedic medicine tradition. And it, you know, you make your makes its way into many dishes.
So what was your goal for this when you guys, when the first issue came out?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I think I got the idea for this magazine actually from a completely different reading series here in Chicago. I think it's called Palabra Pura, which I went and attended, and it was a bilingual Spanish-English reading series. And I went, and my Spanish is not great. It's high school class Spanish. But I was just so struck by the richness of that, of being able to go back and forth. And as a writer myself, trying to write about Sri Lanka, I'm very aware of sort of the way in which diasporan voices sometimes get magnified compared to homeland voices. We have access to sort of the New York publishing world, et cetera, right?
That's a really interesting point, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's almost because we're sort of part of the North American power system and publishing world, we have and have resources a little bit more, perhaps.
Yeah, we have access, right? I was talking to a Sri Lankan writer on Facebook at one point, Pradeep Jagannathan, and we were talking about stakeholding and writing about the war in Sri Lanka, these 30 years of civil war, and it was safe for me to write about it, and because I'm writing in Chicago, it is affecting my relatives, but I was not afraid that anyone was going to come after me directly for writing about it. And Pradeep was sort of making the argument that if you are in Colombo in the midst of it and trying to write, you have these greater stakes. And he wasn't saying I shouldn't write about it, but it was kind of a conversation, and it made me think that it will only make our work better if we are listening to each other, if we are reading each other's words, if we are considering, you know, who our audience is. And I think also if you are sort of a South Asian diasporan writer in America, it can be, you have a whole New York publishing industry that's kind of pushing you towards writing for a certain demographic.
Which is?
Well, so when my book came out from HarperCollins,
I should mention you're the author of Bodies in Motion. Is also you. Not only are you the, I should add all of your. You're the. You also are at UIC where you teach English. But yeah, you.
So I had this book. It came out from HarperCollins in 2005, and we were looking at cover designs, and they had put this woman wrapped in a piece of sari fabric. She wasn't actually wearing a blouse. Her skin was wet. It was quite a racy picture. And I looked at it and I was like, look, my dad won't pick this up. You know, other South Asians, they're not going to be comfortable picking this up. And it's kind of misleading. This isn't what the book is about. And they said, South Asians aren't your target demographic. And I said, what is my target demographic? And the editor at HarperCollins said, white women ages 40 to 60, because that's who buys most fiction in America. And that's sort of who they aim towards. And so I feel like that really skews what gets published, right? And it skews even what we write. If what, you know, the first year I was writing, you know, just out of college, an English major, all of my characters were white. I wrote 20 stories and they all had white people and I didn't even notice, right? I was surrounded by whiteness. And so I kind of reflected that in my fiction. And it's been a long process to realize that. And I think it's a process that a lot of writers go through. And I think we have to kind of keep asking this question of what audiences are we writing for at any given point? You know, when I write about Sri Lanka, I try now to keep my family, my sisters in mind, and I want to make it as complex and nuanced for them as possible. And I, of course, hope other people will get stuff out of it. but I think we have to be careful about who the primary audience is, because it shapes the work.
And so this is an online literary magazine. There's this summer edition that's just out has fiction stories. There's a fiction story about refugees leaving Sri Lanka a housewife, or as she describes, only a housewife. Poetry. There's a poem about a Muslim woman in the middle of divorce. There's interviews. There's reviews. There's art. Is the idea then that the audience is intended to be South Asians, diasporic, or there?
You know, I mean, I hope the audience is a global audience, obviously. We would love to have it read very widely by everyone. I think it's just kind of a question of who you make central and who you're talking to initially. When even in submitting to the magazine, we don't say you have to be South Asian to submit. We invite submissions from people with a deep connection to South Asia. So if you are someone who's white, who moved to India and has lived there for 20 years, perhaps married someone there, had kids, we would love to hear your stories, right? Because clearly you're going to have a deep connection to the culture and the community, right?
Do you think there's enough conversation between different South Asians? You were born in Sri Lanka, and Illinois, we have such a large Indian and Pakistani community. And do you think that this might be a way for people to connect culturally in ways that they might or might not as much socially?
That's interesting. It's so much easier to find community and culture now than it was like when I was right out of college, for example. I remember, growing up in Connecticut in Sri Lanka, my family was in the first wave of Sri Lankans that came to that area. I was the oldest girl. There's, 30 families. And we were very isolated. We would drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to see each other. So mostly, I went to a Polish Catholic school. I studied Polish for 4 years. Minojce synai duha shintego amen. Right? And so it's been a harder process, I think, connecting to the culture. And I certainly hope that when people read the magazine, they may see aspects that they wouldn't have run across otherwise. We have a review, actually, by Jessica Cormos, I think, who is white. And she reviewed a book on bad South Asian girls, essentially. Good Girls Marry Doctors is, I think, the title. And one of the things she says in her review at the end is how surprised she was to sort of by her own assumptions about what it meant to be a South Asian woman, and reading through these stories, seeing all of these different complex perspectives gave her a better understanding of the nuance of culture.
Well, which is interesting, because as I'm thinking about this, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I think, when you and I were first having conversations about when you were starting this, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about how much has changed in terms of pop culture mm-hmm. in South Asians and now. And I'm thinking particularly in the U.S. Of Aziz Ansari. We have Master of None,
which is amazing.
Which is the second. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I was a bigger fan of the second season, but it's an amazing series. I think all of us have sat, at least I have sat my parents down to watch the Asian Parent episode, right? Because it's just great. The Big Sick, which is just out now.
I have not seen it yet.
It's great. Chicago and Pakistani American story. And as we're seeing more, I would say, it's an interesting Asian American, but particularly South Asian presence in, I would say, Hollywood.
Although still kind of a male South Asian presence,
that's
right?
That's what I was going to say.
I think that aside from Mindy Kaling, who I love, I love her, and I'm so glad that when her show got canceled, it got picked up on Hulu, and I watch, fervently, even though I don't necessarily like everything she does, but, she doesn't. It's sort of unfair to ask that she represent all
right, she represents
South Asia, right?
Just a bit. Just a few billion, maybe a billion women. That's all,
Or even even if you limited to South Asian Americans, there's still a lot of us, right? I mean, the real answer to that is more representation, more stories, more complexity. When I wrote Bodies in Motion, I remember thinking, this is the first, as far as I knew, the first Sri Lankan American fiction being published, right? Because I was in that first wave, and I had this terror of representation that people would expect that my characters would tell them what Sri Lankan
the entire
women
country,
were like.
Right? Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And so the you know what I ended up doing was instead of writing a novel, I wrote 20 short stories with 20 different women, or more than 20 different women in the stories. So that I was like, well, this way they can't just pick one to be the Sri Lankan woman. I don't know if it worked, but that was part of the idea.
Mm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
there's 20 different mothers, and you know they can't. As I said to my mom, they're not all you. You know,
so. I was going to ask how hard it's been to put this together, to do something like this. So this is because you're a writer. You know you're an author. You write a lot of science fiction as mm-hmm. well as in other. So you're kind of in that world. You know you teach. You're at US. You're a mom. Like I wonder how all of like how hard it is to put and how many people are involved in putting together Jaggery.
Oh, there are about 20 to 30 people at any given time. I think the tricky thing is we are not Chicago based. We're not place based, mm-hmm. Which has advantages and disadvantages. The obvious advantage is that we can draw editorial talent from across the world, right? And that's great. But it also means that you are running the magazine essentially entirely online in a kind of it's easy to lose track of, honestly, right? I previously ran a magazine, Strange Horizons, and that was on a weekly schedule. And the advantage to that was, you know, you had to get the issue out every week, right? So you were always kind of thinking about it in the back of your head. Jaggery aims for 3 times a year. And so it ebbs and flows a little bit more, the pace of the work. When you're running up to an issue, there's a lot to do in the last week or two before it goes live, and then it goes quiet again for a while. So I think that's hard. And, you know, could I have done it only with people in Chicago? That would also have been hard because there's sort of cultural pressure still not to go into the arts, right? And so the community of South Asian writers in any given American city is still, I would say, not that big. You know, it's bigger in New York. There's a great poetry community in D.C. You know, there are these enclaves, but you're still, you know, South Asians are still close enough to that first wave of immigration that there's a lot of pressure to go into business, medicine, you know, anything that will provide a stable income, and the arts are not necessarily a stable income.
Yeah. So I guess before we go, I just want to ask sort of as you're looking forward, like what this issue is out now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to end by leaving us by reading an excerpt from one of these things? One of the submissions. This is a fiction story you picked,
yes,
right?
Yes, this is a fiction story. I don't know. I just loved it. This is a little after the opening, The Fragrance of Freedom by Padma Prasad. Small shook his head again and said, "Ask me 100 times, the answer is the same. Only one answer. No parents. Final." Shivkali's refugee operation, now in its 5th year, was quite successful. It was dangerous, but he made it work, mostly because he oversaw everything. Also, he moved his headquarters frequently, enough to escape the Indian peacekeeping force, the Sri Lankan army, and the Tamil Tigers. Young men were becoming scarce, and army recruiters wandered around the small towns and villages ruthlessly looking out for them. Shivkali's rules were clear. Payment, a week before boarding date, 60,000 rupees per head. No accountability after they boarded the ship. One trip every month, and he used 2 cargo liners interchangeably. The average age of each one was between 20 and 30. Below 20 would be considered maximum 35. Preference for men. Occasional women on a case-by-case basis, no more than 10 per consignment. No parents, no sick people, definitely no parents.
Okay, if you want to read the rest of that, you can go to jaggerylit.com. It's an online literary journal, an international one, started right here in Chicago. Its founder, Marianne Mohan Raj, has been with us talking just a little bit about it. Marianne, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. On this program, we've talked a lot about the microbiome. That's the trillions of bacteria that live in our gut and all over our bodies and what impact it has on our health. There's some new research involving baby pigs that adds to our understanding of the microbiome. It raises many questions about the role of gut bacteria in infant brain development, including a possible link to autism. To help us learn more about all of this, I'm joined by two of the University of Illinois researchers involved in this study, which was published in July in the journal Gut Microbes. Ryan Dilger is an associate professor in the Department of Animal Sciences. Austin Mudd is a doctoral student in the neuroscience program. Ryan, Austin, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks for having us.
Ryan, one of the goals of this work was to understand how our gut bacteria interact with neurochemicals or chemicals in the brain, known as neurometabolites. What were you hoping to find out, Ryan?
Well, this is really a preclinical study that we're looking at here, where we want to understand how the bacteria that are present in and on the body are having an effect on the host, in this case, the animal. So here we were looking to understand this complex relationship between bacteria, which are technically outside the body, and what's actually happening inside the body in the pig in this way. So we have characterized how development occurs over time in the pig. And here we want to understand the relationship between those bacteria and brain development.
What is it about pigs, or I guess in this case, piglets, right, that make them a good model for understanding human infant brains?
Well, the pig has been used for many years, a couple decades actually, for looking at pediatric nutrition. So we know as a model for gut development and even immune development, the pig's been used in this regard for many years. Here we're actually extending that into the brain, and we know that the pig brain on a gross scale is going to grow very similar to that of the human brain. So again, we're using the pig as a preclinical model with application towards the pediatric realm.
I see. So preclinical meaning before you do human trials or try this on humans, you're trying this, you're doing the research on pigs.
That's right. And there are specific examples where it would be ethically challenging to be able to obtain the types of samples we're talking about. So we are able to use the pig and get at more of a mechanism for the effects that we're seeing.
Right, because again, we're talking about piglet brains, I assume, in that sort of the correlation. Austin, can you explain what we know about the effect that gut bacteria has on chemicals that are involved in brain development in baby pigs?
Right, so I think one of the interesting things about this study in particular is that this is really the first time that we've been able to start to form this relationship or understand this relationship between the specific gut microbes and these brain metabolites. So unfortunately, I don't know that I can actually say that there's much other work out there besides what we have that show these direct relationships. And I think that's what's really interesting about this and hopefully hypothesis generating. So as people begin to read our work, we encourage them to look at the same things and try to expand upon the hypotheses that we've set forth.
And so when we're talking about gut bacteria, and in this case, infant pigs, where is the bacteria coming from? Is that coming from the mom? How do infants end up? How do we know where gut bacteria comes from when we're talking about children or infants?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so in this way, we're talking about colonization. So we're born essentially into a sterile environment, and shortly after birth, especially with pigs, if we think about on the farm, they're going to be colonized because they are interacting with fecal material from their mom, their brothers and sisters, from their environment in general. So the gut over time, over the first month or so of life in the pig, will begin to have this colonization where we have these commensal bacteria that are present in the intestine.
So like humans, pigs are born with sort of a clean slate in terms of bacteria.
Exactly.
And how much of the bacteria that you looked at, so were you all able to sort of isolate where the bacteria was coming from in terms of where their environment? Or, Austin, did you just look at what was sort of in the pigs that you had?
Yeah, we more or less just characterized what was there and not necessarily where it came from. So that would actually be an interesting future study, I suppose, to look at whether it's a dietary thing or whether it's from the environment and what aspects of the environment might be influencing those changes in the microbiota that we're observing.
How did you go about trying to understand the link between the bacteria and the microbiome and brain development?
I mean, really what we were trying to do here was to bring multiple big data sets together. So a microbiome data set in itself is big data, quotes around that. Mm-hmm. And then to bring in a lot of the metabolomics that we have for understanding all the metabolites that are circulating within the body of that pig, along with all the neuroimaging data, that's really where the novelty is in this hypothesis-generating research. So we're not, again, ascribing a causative relationship between cortisol, specific microbiota, and brain development, but we're showing that there is a relationship there that we could test using the pig in the future.
To expand on what Ryan said, this is really an interdisciplinary approach. So a lot of times what we see is that neuroscientists tend to stay in their field of neuroscience, and within microbiome research, it's a lot of people are doing microbiomes. So we had a unique perspective in that we could start to look across these two disciplines and really understand how they might be influencing each other. So I guess that's what really led us to this, was to start to understand how these two play together and if one is more influential in the other.
So, Ryan, you mentioned that you weren't necessarily, you're not looking at causes, you're just looking at sort of conditions. Can you explain a little bit more about what the research was that you all did then, what you looked at?
Sure. So when in science, we're talking between correlations or associations and causation, having a direct effect. So here we're looking at how the microbiota, the bacteria that are present, correlate or associate with measurements in the blood and how those correlate with those in the brain. And so the mediation analysis that Austin completed here really brings those three together in a really powerful statistical model to be able to then say indirectly the bacteria may be exerting their effect through cortisol in this case to affect the outcomes that we have in terms of neuroimaging that we obtained in the brain.
So for someone who maybe doesn't understand neuroimaging or have sort of the academic level understanding that you guys have in terms of the research, how would you explain this in sort of layman's terms, the kind of research that you did?
So I would say that the research that we were looking at is to really understand, we know that as our brain develops, there's a lot of different processes that are occurring all at once. So as a baby gets older, we commonly hear of things like myelination occurring, that's increases in white matter. We know that brains get bigger over time. So what we were doing, I guess what we do is we look at those changes. And in this study specifically, we are looking at neurometabolites. So we know that specific neurometabolites are essential at different parts of development. And so what we wanted to understand was, do these microbiota at all play into these changes that we know occur in neurometabolism throughout development?
And so, Ryan, as both you and Austin have said, this is very preliminary research. This is preclinical. Can you help us understand potential ties between your findings and research, for example, into possible causes of autism?
That really does go beyond the scope of what we're comfortable talking about here, because we are talking about fundamental relationships that we've identified. Now, there are other studies that are coming out presently, shortly after we had this news release, actually, that have tied some specific bacteria to that in a clinical realm. So we're not kind of extend our findings to that piece. But I do want to kind of come back to the preclinical model, what we're doing in the pig, the translational power that we have with the brain growing the same between humans and pigs, and the fact that the pig is big enough, we actually use human clinical MRI scanners. So the same one that you would use if you went to a hospital. And we actually use the same sequences, and we are trading sequences between pigs and humans so that we can have that direct relationship between them. So we quantify volume, we quantify myelination, how much white matter and gray matter, and then the neurometabolites that we discussed in this particular study are simply those chemicals that are in the brain that are altering mood. So this is getting, again, at some basic changes or differences between the microbiome and how that may affect mood overall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What other questions, Ryan, is your lab, the Pig Nutrition and Cognition Lab, trying to answer?
So my training fundamentally is in nutrition. And so we are really interested on this side of my lab in looking at basic nutritional inputs and how we can mimic what's in breast milk. What are the bioactives that are present there? How can we provide those into an artificial setting like infant milk replacer or for the pig or on the human side, looking at formula? And so basically it's looking at compounds, which are in our food, nutrients, which are going to have effects long-term on brain development on that side. We are also looking at how it affects behavior of the pig. So looking at simple measures of learning and memory, for example, as more of a functional output of brain development. And then the whole other side of my lab has to do with animal agriculture and the sustainable way that we produce high-quality sources of animal protein.
And so imagine piglets are similar to infants in that a lot of the breast milk that comes from the mom actually helps to nurture different bacteria within the gut. Is that the same?
That's correct. And we've actually published on looking at the composition of sow's milk and comparing that to human milk and understanding that there are differences there as well. And a lot of the compounds we focus on are those which can be fermented by bacteria. So simple carbohydrates that we call oligosaccharides, milk oligosaccharides. And so we've now compared the human and the sow's milk composition for those oligosaccharides as, again, a primary driver of that colonization where the bacteria are actually being established in the young animal.
Austin, there sounds like there's a lot we still don't understand about the effects of gut bacteria on infant brain development. What particularly are you most interested in trying to figure out?
I think given the study that we just published, I think it would be really interesting to be able to look at these specific bacterial genera further. So one way that we could start to get at a causative relationship would then be to possibly provide some sort of probiotic or colonize the guts of pigs with these specific microbiota. In this case, it was Ruminococcus. So we could start to elucidate if differing levels of Ruminococcus, for example, might have more of an influence on these neural metabolites. So I think taking what we've done in a correlational way and starting to have specific studies which can get at causative mechanisms. And again, that's still in a preclinical model, but it's one step closer to really understanding what might be happening in a human.
And from a practical standpoint, Ryan, I wonder, Austin's research then, does this then lay the groundwork for possibly clinical work with humans?
It does. So we work with Dr. Sharon Donovan in Food Science Human Nutrition here, who is a pediatric nutritionist on the human side, and she uses the pig in the same way. And she has ongoing trials clinically for understanding the relationship between the microbiota, these bacteria, and especially gut and immune development as well. So in working with her, we've actually gone to the point where we could colonize pigs that are born sterile with a specific type of bacteria, notobiotic or germ-free animals in that way, to very carefully understand how they are administering this relationship in the absence of other bacteria. And I will point out that we know that there are differences between the bacterial profiles of a pig and a human. But we can take those into context and understand them when we raise these pigs artificially for getting at these relationships between bacterial metabolism and ultimately brain development in the animal.
So hopefully that means eventually down the road this could perhaps lead to different understandings of probiotics that different humans should be consuming, or particularly infants.
Absolutely. And those are some of the nutritional products that you're seeing today that we are testing in this type of model. Yes.
That's Ryan Dilger. He's an associate professor in the Department of Animal Sciences at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Austin Mudd as well. He's a doctoral student in the neuroscience program at U of I, joining us to talk about their cutting-edge research that they're really looking at in terms of gut microbes and infant brain development. Gentlemen, both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Search for our Facebook page, Like the 21st. You can comment there, too, on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Bob Holly, and Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance of the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.